Good morning. This is Ron Falk with the UNC Kidney Center, and with me today is Dr. David Weber, who is a professor of medicine, pediatrics, and an infectious disease specialist who knows lots about hospital epidemiology. He's here today to talk with us about the do's and don'ts of vaccination and immunization in immunocompromised patients. So, David, thank you so much and welcome here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Let's start with a general question of what are general recommendations for immunization in immunocompromised patients?
Well, first of all, prevention is superior to treatment, and immunizations are an important component of preventing infections in immunocompromised individuals. There are really three guiding rules. First, inactivated vaccines are safe in immunocompromised individuals. Now, they may have less seroconversion and lower titers, but the vaccines are perfectly safe. Two, in general, live virus vaccines, mumps, measles, rubella, varicella, zoster, and the live attenuated influenza vaccine are contraindicated in immunocompromised individuals.
So, David, let's just pause there. Contraindicated means patients shouldn't take those.
That is correct. While they're immunocompromised, they should not take those vaccines.
Let's go through that list one more time, please.
Mumps, measles, rubella, varicella, and the live attenuated influenza vaccine. I should also say the zoster vaccine.
So the zoster, the shingles vaccine, is a live vaccine.
It is.
And what's then the third general rule?
And the third general rule is that immunization of household members is safe both with inactivated vaccines and all live attenuated vaccines, with the exception of smallpox vaccine.
So that means that if a grandparent gets the shingles vaccine, the zoster vaccine, and it's a live vaccine, any other member of the household who's immunosuppressed is safe.
That is correct. And in fact, it's an important part of protecting that immunocompromised individual because they are most likely to get these diseases from someone in the household. And by immunizing the people around them to prevent them from, for instance, getting shingles, that will protect them.
And that, I'm sure, is also very much true for the influenza vaccine. There are various forms of those as well. Can you tell us the various kinds of flu shots or flu vaccines available?
There are currently four different types of flu vaccines. They all contain exactly the same viruses, but they're delivered in different ways. We've already mentioned the live attenuated flu vaccine, which should not be given to immunocompromised individuals, and it's licensed for adults up to age 49.
Is that the one you get in the nose?
That is the inhaled vaccine that you get in the nose, and some people prefer it because there is no needle involved and no shot. And again, that can be given safely to household members of immunocompromised individuals. In addition, there's the standard vaccine, the standard IM shot, which is available for all persons over the age of 6 months and should be given yearly. Recently, there are two new vaccines introduced. One is an intradermal vaccine, and the second is a high titer vaccine, which has four times the antigen load and has been FDA approved and CDC recommended for people over the age of 65. However, although it gives you higher titers and better seroconversion, there are no studies yet showing that it has superior efficacy. It just has not been studied. And for that reason, the CDC, ACIP don't make a specific recommendation between that and the standard IM shot.
So let me go through those again. There's the flu vaccine that we all know about that is an intramuscular or an IM injection. There is an injection that is in the skin, the intradermal injection. There is the inhaled live attenuated vaccination that you get in the nose. And now there's a fourth one. The fourth one has more viral particles in it, although they're dead viral particles. And you're suggesting that's potentially better for people who are over the age of 65.
Yes, it's been well studied in people over the age of 65. More of them seroconvert to what we believe might be a protective level. And those levels of antibody are statistically higher than if they received the standard IM shot.
But there must be more side effects with that vaccination than because it has more viral particles in it than the standard flu shot.
And that is exactly true. People are more likely to have local side effects, pain, tenderness, swelling with this vaccine, although it's still relatively mild and can generally be treated just with Tylenol and a cold compress. But it is true, people do have somewhat more local side effects.
So if you were over the age of 65, David, and you had to get the flu vaccine, which one would you get?
So particularly if I was immunocompromised, I would get the high titer vaccine.
The rest of us should be getting probably the regular flu vaccine right now.
That's exactly right. The CDC explicitly says that a patient should receive the flu vaccine as soon as it becomes available, because you don't want to miss opportunities of patients coming in and seeing you only every 4 months. You wouldn't want to miss the chance to immunize them before influenza appears. And we have peaked as early as November, as late as May for flu each year, although classically in the United States, we peak in February. And the data suggests that the vaccine will provide protection through the entire flu season.
So how well the vaccine works doesn't diminish after 4 or 5 months?
That is correct.
It stays constant protection throughout the whole flu vaccine period.
In fact, the CDC states that it lasts for up to 12 months, and so the answer is it will cover you through the entire influenza season.
How long does the flu vaccine take to work?
This is true for almost all vaccines, at least those that are a single dose for efficacy. It takes, in general, 1 to 3 weeks to build up sufficient antibody for that vaccine to be protective. And again, that's another reason for vaccinating early, not waiting until we begin seeing influenza in the community.
So let me review this. If you're an immunocompromised patient who's under the age of 65, a regular flu shot is what you should take.
Yes, as soon as possible.
As soon as possible. If you're over the age of 65, you might want to consider this revved up higher antigen load flu shot. How do you ask your doctor for that shot, incidentally?
You would simply ask for the high titer flu shot. It's made by Sanofi, and your physician should know about it. It's both FDA approved and ACIP recommended.
And for if you have a child in the house who is in grade school, for example, that child could have the flu vaccine in their nose with no problem for the rest of the family.
Yes, as long as they were old enough. The IM shot can be given down to 6 months of age. The inhaled shot, you have to be somewhat older. But again, there's no risk. This virus is a cold adapted virus. So actually, it's a little different than our standard attenuated viruses. It actually cannot survive in the lower respiratory tract because the higher temperature kills the virus. And there really has not been evidence of transmission of this virus to contacts.
You would almost suggest then that the whole family should be vaccinated one way or the other, either with the inhaled vaccine or with the flu shot, to protect the immunocompromised patient living in that environment.
Absolutely. Not only for flu, but for all the other standard vaccines, providing a bubble of protection around the immunocompromised person is critical. And of course, they have their most contact with their family members. So it's very important for family members to be immune to the standard diseases like flu and pertussis to protect that immunocompromised individual.
So let's move now to that next vaccination, the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, or DPT, although sometimes physicians only provide the diphtheria and tetanus vaccine. What's your suggestion?
Well, let's start off with the standard TD shot, which is tetanus and diphtheria toxins. And of course, as children, we get a primary series with this vaccine, and then we get a booster every 10 years. Now, in childhood, rather than use the TD, we use what's called the DTAP, diphtheria, tetanus, acellular pertussis. They get a series of this up to age 7, protects against tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. And the acellular pertussis is much safer than the old whole cell pertussis. Starting at age 7, we switch to a different vaccine called TDAP, tetanus, diphtheria, A. Sailor pertussis, and we can't confuse them because this is only given to adolescents and adults, has the same constituents but in different amounts, and this will protect adolescents and adults against pertussis. And it is recommended for all persons over the age of 7 to get at least one dose of the TDAP to protect against pertussis.
How frequently should you get that vaccination?
Right now, only a single dose is recommended. Of course, the vaccine's not been out 10 years, and the recommendations may change sometime in the future. But right now, it's only a single dose of TDAP that's recommended. It's particularly important for adolescents and adults who have contact with young children, either because they have them in the household or by virtue of occupation, such as school teachers, healthcare workers, because most young children acquire pertussis from family members or other close contacts.
Let me review this then for a minute. If I go to an emergency room or an urgent care, and because I've cut myself on or stuck myself with a rusty nail, and the physician wants to give me a tetanus shot, which shot should I get?
If you've not had TDAP, you should get the TDAP shot. It's perfectly protective against both tetanus and diphtheria, as well as pertussis. If you happen to have gotten this shot 4 or 5 years ago, but you have a particularly contaminated wound and the ED physician thinks you need a booster, then you should get a TD shot.
But if you haven't had that pertussis vaccination, and you're over the age of 7, you probably should get this combined vaccination.
That is absolutely correct.
Now, is that a safe vaccine for members of the household of an immunosuppressed patient?
This is not a live virus vaccine. It's perfectly safe both for the immunocompromised individual as well as for anyone in the household.
Let's go over this acellular pertussis vaccination when compared to the old pertussis shot. The old vaccination caused lots of side effects. Are you suggesting then that this acellular pertussis form has less side effects and is safer?
In fact, I am. So if the tetanus diphtheria shot is probably the most reactogenic shot we use, about 50% of people will, again, have local side effects, sore arm, pain, and redness. Adding in the acellular pertussis component doesn't increase either the frequency or severity of the side effects over just a standard TD shot.
So the question I get a lot is, I got a flu shot and it gave me the flu. I got this acellular pertussis vaccine and I started to cough and developed pertussis. Is that possible?
No. You cannot get any of the either flu from flu shots or pertussis from the pertussis shot. And particularly for flu, there are a lot of misconceptions. The first is, well, I took the shot, but I still got the flu. Of course, most people will get 2 or 3 respiratory infections in a winter, but most of them are going to be parainfluenza, human metapneumovirus, rhinoviruses, echoviruses, but people lump those all into the flu and think it failed. That's the first thing. The second thing is you cannot get flu from the flu shot, even the live attenuated one. You might get a little bit of a stuffy nose, but it can't replicate in the lungs because of its temperature susceptibility. Now, it is true, none of the vaccines we have, the flu vaccines, are perfectly protective. But it is important to realize, even in a bad match year, people in the newspaper will talk about it only being 50 to 70% effective. But that's for preventing flu. It might be 80 to 90% protective for preventing hospitalization and 85 to 90% or more effective for preventing death. So this vaccine is better at ameliorating disease than totally preventing it, and therefore it's critical to give to our patients, particularly immunocompromised patients.
Let's move on to the pneumonia shot, Pneumovax. When and how often should an immunocompromised patient get that vaccine?
Let's start off with the general recommendations. That is, every adult 65 and above should get the polysaccharide Pneumovax vaccine. For adults between the ages of 2 and 64 who are immunocompromised or who have host-deficient abnormalities such as chronic renal failure, diabetes, liver failure, all of those should also get the Pneumovax vaccine. Now, revaccination is probably the most difficult concept to understand. Let's first start off with the older adults. If you were under 65 when you got the first dose, and now you're over 65, and more than 5 years have passed, you get a single revaccination after 5 years. If you're 65 and above when you got your first dose, there are no revaccination recommendations. So you have this little bit strange recommendation. If you're 64, when you turn 69, you get a single revaccination. If you were 65, when you turn 70, you don't. If you're under 65, you get a single dose. If you're highly immunocompromised, asplenic, HIV, if you're over 10, you get a single revaccination dose after 5 years. If you're between 2 and 10, you get a single revaccination dose after 3 years. There are no CDC or FDA recommendations for more than a single revaccination dose, although in reading the literature, there are review articles that treat it similar to tetanus, saying give a revaccination every 5 or 10 years, but there's no evidence to support that, and it's not a recommendation.
Wow, that's a complicated strategy for the Pneumovax. Let me see if I understand it. Everybody should get at least one Pneumovax injection.
At age 65.
At age 65. What about an immunocompromised person at the age of 40?
Everyone who's immunocompromised between the age of 2 and 65 should get initially a dose of Pneumovax, followed 5 years later by a revaccination.
So that's probably the simplest message. If you're immunosuppressed, on immunosuppressive medicines, you should get one dose, and 5 years later, you should remember to get that second revaccination dose, unless you're magically hit the age of 65, in which case you don't need the revaccination. Did I get that one right?
You did.
Okay, good. What about household members? Should they get the Pneumovax?
The answer in general is no, unless they themselves meet one of the criteria for getting it. However, the conjugate pneumococcal vaccine is recommended for all children, and this should be given to children because not only does it prevent disease in very young children, but it decreases the risk of colonization in the children and has actually been shown to decrease the risk of older people who are in the vicinity of those people because we acquire our pneumonia, our pneumococci, from the children, and it actually decreases resistance as well.
So let me use the example again. As a 49-year-old patient who is immunosuppressed, and they have a 10-year-old child living in the house, what would you suggest they should do with a 10-year-old child?
The answer, there is no indication in that case to give the 10-year-old child a polysaccharide vaccine. The conjugate vaccine is used only for very young children under the age of 2.
So it's only the 2-year-old that would need it, not the 10-year-old.
That's correct.
Okay, good. Moving then to the zoster or shingles vaccine, that's the other one that we are asked about all the time as well. What's the general recommendation? And then what's the recommendation for the immunosuppressed patient?
So this is a live attenuated vaccine. We have two forms. We have the varicella vaccine, which is given to adults, adolescents, and young children. And we have the zoster vaccine that has been FDA and CDC recommended for people, everybody at age 60. Just recently, the FDA approved this vaccine for people at age 50, but the ACIP has not made its recommendations yet. The zoster vaccine is the same as the chickenpox vaccine, but it has 14.3 times increased potency. Both vaccines are contraindicated and people are immunocompromised.
So let me say that again. It's recommended for individuals, normal individuals over the age of 60. If a person's immunocompromised, they're on immunosuppressive medicines, they should just not get the zoster vaccine or shingles vaccine at all.
That's correct. Now, for instance, however, if you had somebody who had a renal failure and you knew they were going to get an organ transplant in a year or two, you may want to safely immunize them at that point. But once they become immunocompromised by drugs or other diseases such as HIV, cancer, on chemotherapy, then they should not receive the zoster vaccine.
And what about the husband, wife, or grandparents?
If it's indicated, meaning that the family members are over the age of 60 by ACIP and over the age of 50 now by the FDA, it would be reasonable to immunize those individuals. And the guidelines specifically say it's safe for the immunocompromised household member.
And does that provide some kind of bubble of protection for the immunosuppressed patient?
It does, because by the time people reach age 60 to 70, roughly a third of people have had an episode of shingles. And by the time they're 85, 50% of people have had an episode of shingles. And of course, shingles can transmit chickenpox. So if that immunocompromised person has not had chickenpox, this would protect them.
And shingles just does not feel good at any time.
People don't realize how severe shingles is. As you get older, the risk of postherpetic neuralgia, which is a major complication, frequency goes up, severity of pain goes up, and duration goes up. And actually, the pain, acute pain of shingles, is rated by women as more intense than labor pain. And the chronic pain of shingles is rated by men as more intense than cancer pain. So this is a severe disease.
So despite what the difference is in the two guidelines, you, if it were you at the age of 50, you probably would get your, and you were not immunocompromised, you were a normal person, you would get your shingles vaccine.
I would.
Let me turn to children for a moment. We have lots of children who are immunosuppressed. They're on prednisone or have gotten other immunosuppressive drugs. Do they get their usual vaccines?
So children who are immunocompromised would get all their usual inactivated vaccines on the same schedule as any other child. So things like inactivated polio, Haemophilus influenza, pneumococci, HPV in an adolescent 11, 12-year-old female or even male now, would get all their standard vaccines. The one difference here is if at some point in the future their immunosuppression is weaned or eliminated because it's no longer necessary, then they should be revaccinated. A normal person would just go through the basic series and not receive additional vaccines. But an immunosuppressed person, if the immunosuppression can be weaned off, would get revaccinated to make sure they have adequate protection.
What are the vaccinations that those immunosuppressed children should not get?
Again, they should not get live virus vaccines, live attenuated vaccines, of which mumps, measles, rubella, varicella are the really major live virus vaccines that we currently use and for which we don't have any inactivated choices.
So I want to do that. Have you do that list again slowly, because this is the important one. Mumps, measles, rubella, varicella, or the chickenpox vaccine. Those are the ones that immunosuppressed children should stay away from.
That is correct.
Are there other common vaccines that we should talk about with respect to the immunosuppressed patient?
The answer is yes, particularly hepatitis B, and particularly for those immunocompromised individuals that might have a higher risk of exposure. So exposures such as needing hemodialysis in the future or currently, individuals obviously working in healthcare, people who are going to travel to lesser developed countries, they should be immunized against hepatitis B. The schedule is the same, 0, 1, and 6 months. If they are renal failure or hemodialysis, again, as with influenza, we have a high titer vaccine that has 40 micrograms of antigen, and those individuals should receive the high titer vaccine. While this vaccine has not been studied in other immunocompromised individuals besides renal failure, I think it's reasonable for any immunocompromised individual for whom the hepatitis B vaccine is indicated to receive the high titer vaccine. It's safe and has a higher likelihood of leading to protection.
Before we finish, let me just ask you another general question. Many times patients are very concerned about taking vaccinations for fear they're going to get the disease, for fear they're going to develop neurological problems from these vaccines or other disease complications from the vaccinations themselves. Help dispel some of those myths.
Vaccines are incredibly safe. Side effects beyond sort of local pain and irritation are extraordinarily rare. As we talked about, I do the occupational health here at UNC. I or my nurses have personally provided more than 100,000 vaccines since I've done this activity for 15 years. For instance, we've never had an employee who had anaphylaxis. We've never had an employee who required hospitalization as a result of side effects. That said and done, there are rare side effects to vaccines. However, the benefits are enormously greater than any of the risks, and that's why they're recommended.
So what you're telling us all to do is to make sure we talk to our health care provider about getting the flu shot as soon as it comes out, about getting the diphtheria, acellular pertussis, tetanus shot at least once after 7 years old, to get the pneumovax revaccinated as depending upon our age, and to consider getting the shingles vaccine or the zoster vaccine after the age of 50, that it's safe for the household members to take any of these vaccinations, even if they are live vaccinations, that it's safe for them. And in fact, it provides a bubble of protection to the immunocompromised patient. Any other last words of wisdom before we stop?
Yes, I just want to mention briefly two other vaccines. One would be hepatitis A, again, specifically indicated for people who might be traveling to lesser developed countries or who have underlying liver problems at all, because the last thing you want to do on top of one liver disease is get another injury to your liver. Again, inactivated vaccine, very safe. And finally, we have the HPV vaccine, which is recommended for women age 9 through 26, and at least the Merck vaccine can also be given to men age 9 through 26. And again, it's an inactivated vaccine, safe in immunocompromised individuals, and we should be, to the extent we can, protecting those individuals against the risks of cervical cancer, vulvar cancer, vaginal cancer, and anal cancer, as well as potentially genital warts as well.
Tell us once again that age range where that vaccination should be given.
The range that's FDA approved is age 9 through 26, but the target range is 11 to 12. And I should say at 11 to 12, we have this adolescent bundle now of HPV. We give them the TDAP to protect their SIBs. And one other vaccine, which I didn't mention, the meningococcal vaccine, which is recommended for all young children, but for adolescents and adults, would be used for only for people who have special risks for meningococcus, such as complement deficiency.
And if your child is going off to college and they're immunosuppressed, should they get the meningococcal vaccine?
The answer is yes, they should get the meningococcal vaccine. Again, it's not a live virus vaccine, and it's perfectly safe in immunocompromised individuals.
Dr. Weber, thank you so much for spending time with us explaining to us about vaccinations. We really appreciate your time and efforts. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.